Guests on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. Today, I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. Today, we're going to be talking about journalism with one of the really outstanding journalists in America today in the United States, one of the great working journalists. Charles Lewis is the founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit, nonpartisan watchdog organization in Washington that does investigative reporting and research on public policy issues. Chuck Lewis has written or co-written several of the Center's books and studies that systematically track political influence, including The Cheating of America, The Buying of the President 2000, The Buying of the Congress, and most recently in the book that's just come out that we want to talk about today, The Buying of the President 2004. In 1998, Chuck Lewis was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The list goes on and on of people who rave about Chuck Lewis and his organization, but I'd urge all listeners to do, if you're interested in knowing about the work of Chuck Lewis and the work of the Center for Public Integrity, go to their website, www.publicintegrity.org. Chuck, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's really a privilege to have you on the program.
Well, thanks for the kind words. I appreciate them.
Well, they're well deserved.
It's a pleasure to be talking to you. We have a mutual admiration society, I guess. I'm in all of your work.
Well, I appreciate that. And one of the reasons I got to know about Chuck Lewis's work and the Center for Public Integrity's work as well as I've gotten to know about it is that among the other many research projects that have been undertaken by the center, one of them has been on the lobbying efforts by powerful commercial interests in the area of media and telecommunications influence policies, and really pace-setting work that sort of set the standard for understanding what goes on in Washington when all these important policies and subsidies are developed. And it's really been impressive work, and that drew my attention to you several years ago. And it's kept it there.
Well, thanks. And as you know, it's continuing. We're continuing to watch all those folks, and we have some reports coming out this year on those subjects.
Yeah, and I want to talk about those later today. But sure. The first thing I want to talk about, Chuck, is the new book out, "The Buying of the President 2004." And this is the third in this series. Is that correct?
Yeah, we did it in '96 and 2000, so this is our third.
And you're the lead author, but it's with the entire staff. A lot of the staff have contributed, I take it, during the
research. It sounds like Gone with the Wind. I mean, with an epic production of 53 researchers, writers, editors, took a year, and just a wonderful effort by so many people, and including some grad students at American University. And we interviewed 600 people and went through just the campaign contribution data for all the presidential candidates going back to the beginning of their political careers, and involved 2 million state and federal records. But then altogether have something like 10 or 12 data sets from state and federal records, from court records, from IRS and Securities and Exchange Commission and other types of records, financial disclosure information about all these folks, you name it. And all of that is then woven into material about each of the candidates, but also, as you know, there's a lot of stuff, small d democracy stuff, about the state of our political process, where, you know, I was able to talk to some interesting folks like former President Carter and former presidential candidates John McCain and Robert Dole and some others. And so it's pretty loaded, actually. It's about 50% longer as a book than the first book we did in '96. So it's got a roundness to it in terms of how much is in there compared to the earliest book we did on these presidential candidates.
Yeah, in fact, I would say that this book, Chuck Lewis, The Buying of the President 2004, you know, to hear you describe it with all these research assistants and all this data and material might give someone the sense that this is going to be a heavy wonk book, only of interest to people who just have a slide rule out and really are into the esoteria of this. And that, to put it bluntly, that is the exact opposite way I would interpret this book. This book is truly a page-turner. I mean, I've been reading it the last couple of days. And just when we were on the air here, I was so engrossed in it, I almost missed the cue to go on the air. It's really, if you like politics, if you like public life, if you're interested in how power works in the society, this book is not dry. This is really an exciting book, and I want to give it high praise on those grounds. It's really quite readable.
Well, thanks. No, we thanks for saying that. We also believe internally that it's probably the most readable thing we've ever published, actually. More, not just the president books. We've done 12 books in coming up on 15 years, and this one, you know, we had a great editing team of Bill Allison and Tio Furtado and Alan Green, and, you know, their pedigrees are pretty impressive. There's about 50 or 60 years of editing experience in among the three of them, and so that, you know, when you have that many people working on something, you've got to polish the writing to have one kind of narrative voice for the book. And while I wrote about 35,000 of the 120,000 words at the front and the back, it has to read seamlessly. And mm-hmm. the writing is actually almost as much of a challenge as the research.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand that, having done books like this and knowing the difficulty of it. I can say you pulled it off. Now, this book, the subtitle to it, the title, of course, The Buying of the President 2004, the subtitle is Who's Really Bankrolling Bush and His Democratic Challengers and What They Expect in Return. And I think that, you know, listeners of this program are familiar with this, and I think people who follow politics are familiar with the role money plays, because you hear these numbers that candidates are raising. And they're mind-boggling. It's getting to the point they're sort of like NBA salaries. They're so large, they lose any connection to the world you live in. And maybe you could let's start by just talking first with Bush, and then I would definitely want to go through Kerry, the likely Democratic challenger. You know, give some sense of who is really bankrolling Bush and Kerry and what these funders expect in return. Let's start with Bush.
Well, Bush, you know, just one stat, 600,000 a day is how much he's pulling in. So without going in, you know, yes, 131 million last year, more than double his, or about double his other record-shattering numbers from the 2000 election. But so we've never ever, I don't think planet Earth has ever seen a person pulling cash in like he is. And it's bundling from individuals, executives really, from all the major companies. His top patron until a few weeks ago and throughout his career has been Enron, the disgraced bankrupt company that more than 20 people have been convicted of now of fraud. It turns out that you know, this relationship with Enron goes way back to the 1980s, and we talk about the relationship. We unearthed dozens of letters between Kenneth Lay, known as Kenny Boy by Bush, before the scandal broke in 2002, and then it was Mr. Lay, and Enron wanted a lot of favors. And we have documented, believe it or not, 49 explicit favors at the state and federal level, going through three presidents, including Clinton, throughout the 90s. But no one got more money from them or did more for them in this country than George W. Bush. And so we talk at great length about that. But oil and gas, when we did the 2000 book, and Bush was emerging as a national figure after only 5 years as a politician, ironically, 14 of his 25 patrons, as we call them, career patrons, people that sponsored his existence financially and politically, were oil and gas interests. And he still, as a former oil man, of course, still has a very strong presence there from oil and gas interests. But the more surprising news is the financial sector, how they have come around him. MBNA has now overtaken Enron as the new money keeps pouring in, and Enron is kind of running out of gas as a bankrupt company. And so MBNA is up there now. Merrill Lynch, Price Waterhouse, Vincent Elkins, UBS, Credit Suisse, Goldman Sachs, Bass Brothers, Ernst & Young. But the biggest accounting firms, some of the biggest stock brokerage firms, and credit card companies, those kinds of interests. Now, it could be MBNA's big issue has been the bankruptcy bill, making it harder for ordinary citizens to write off debt when they get in trouble, favored by all the banks, opposed by consumer groups, et cetera. It could be offshore tax haven issues that, you know, the administration and the banks favor not touching those laws and enabling people to move money. We did another book, The Cheating of America. There are 3 million corporations and $5 trillion in assets offshore. No one has any idea who it belongs to, including the IRS and the UN and Interpol. And then it could be tax cut or dividend tax cut policies, corporate capital gains tax cut policies. I mean, who knows? But they have, in 2000, there were no financial institutions around Bush. Now there's six out of the top 10. And so there is something interesting that has been going on there. But to put it most directly, you know, maximum contributions in America, $2,000 checks now, it used to be $1,000. In 2000's election, the number of people writing checks at the max level that any politician, Clinton, Dole, Gore, had ever found was 19,000 people at one time in one election.
Mm-hmm.
Bush found 58,000, three times the ceiling. Now, he's exceeded that this time. I don't know if it's up to 100,000. No one has made the calculation yet about how many maximum donors he's identified. But a contribution of $2,000 comes from 0.1%. 96% of the American people don't give a penny to anyone in politics.
Now, do you think it's fair to say, Chuck, I mean, just off the top of your head, that the 0.1% that are writing these maximum $2,000 checks tend probably to come from the upper income segment of the population?
Well, no, that's an understatement. Yes, upper. Yeah, most people don't have an extra $2,000 laying around to get a politician, you know. That's fair. And, you know, there have been studies. I mean, most of these folks are middle-aged white guys in their 50s who work for big, you know, corporations, essentially. I mean, that is the profile for the donor. It's actually been investigated and studied by mm-hmm. political scientists and other studies over the years.
And they're they're high up in the executive ranks, I assume.
Well, no, very high up in the executive ranks. And you know, one of the things that is kind of weird about this is, if there's an email from the CEO to the staff saying, let's all each give $2,000 to George W. Bush, that's illegal. And so what happens is they all get bonuses, or it's all kind of wink, wink, understood that you will give money. And, you know, the bundling, when people talk almost in, like you were sort of saying earlier, the pioneers, you know, a person who raises $100,000—that sounds, oh, how interesting. So there are people who like really raise money for that guy, huh? And it kind of gets lost what the significance is. This politician has found a way to orchestrate, you know, money in a way never seen before, where the checks are numbered, where every industry is basically writing emails saying we've got to make sure we get credit for this, that they know who we are. There are actually emails we talk about in the book where people want to get noticed by the White House, want the White House to know that they're on their side, and they're amassing. It's like a race to see, can our industry or our company outraise other companies, and can we be in greater favor than the other companies and the other industries? And there's never been such shameless, unabashed bundling that has really ever been seen in American politics. And we talk at great length about this in the book. And, of course, $60 million worth of records, despite the fastidious organizational structure and the meticulous nature of this, which has never been seen in American politics, the Bush campaign lost $60 million worth of paperwork explaining their $60 million worth of donors, I guess is a better way to say it. And in the Supreme Court litigation around the McCain-Feingold reform law, this came out, and you know, I say it's akin to saying the dog ate my homework. They could not produce the records, which is kind of creepy. We thought there were 222 pioneers in the 2000 campaign. There were actually 600. The Bush campaign was not, frankly, forthcoming about who these people were or what they were up to, and we still have, I think there are still questions about how they do this.
We're talking to Chuck Lewis today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Chuck Lewis is the executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, a group we'll be talking about in the show today, one of the great investigative research units in the country, and also the author with the center of the new book, The Buying of the President 2004, that we're talking about today in Media Matters. The phone number here, if you'd like to call in and talk to Chuck, is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I mean, you know, one of the things, Chuck, that you hear about campaign contributions, I make them personally. I know friends who make them to candidates they believe in. And you hear these numbers, and the sense you get is that the sort of the idea that they're just people who really want to make the country better and pick a candidate and give $50 or $100 to try to help a candidate along that they believe in, what they stand for. That's really not much of what we're talking about here. This is really investments by industries to get payback. That's what's driving a lot of this money.
Well, that's right. And what's difficult in this conversation and in any analysis of the money is, look, there are some people that are really truly doing it because they believe in it. And, you know, and some people also, their political beliefs are that, you know, have to do with capitalism and democracy and how, you know, how much government should be intervening or regulating or, you know, interacting with the private sector. And some people believe that fervently and has nothing to do with any kind of implicit sense of what their company should do. It has everything to do with their political philosophy. There are people who either believe in a person or an idea or an ideology that give money. There are others who do it for ego reasons, who want to get close to power, want to have FaceTime with a famous person, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's not all, it's not $1, one vote, and, you know, there are different motives for giving. But when you have this kind of orchestration of cash with, you know, 67 executives giving the maximum donation each on the same day, including sometimes their dog and their six-year-old child, there's something much larger going on than just those sort of more innocent or benign motives. And for researchers who gather this up, you know, you just notice who are they and who they work for. You just tally it and let them explain later that it's all innocent.
Now, I know that the Center for Public Integrity is a stridently nonpartisan organization and is not allied with any political party or candidates. Right. And in this book, much of the space goes to making critical analysis of all the then contenders for the Democratic nomination, which we've now pretty much whittled down to John Kerry, at least as the likely nominee. And just a few words before we go to our phone lines, Chuck Lewis, to talk about what you discovered in terms of the people who are giving money to John Kerry.
Well, you know, Kerry has begun his fourth term as a senator. He's been on the scene in Washington for over 20 years. And, you know, he's on the Finance and Commerce Committees in the Senate. And, you know, just by way of comparison, he has raised about 60, probably a little more now, maybe 65 even, million dollars in his political career of some 20 years. $60 million. Bush has raised about $300 million in half the time. He's been a politician, at least officially, for about 10 years. So both of these candidates are well acquainted with raising money and raising money from powerful interests. One has raised five times more than the other, but you know, Kerry has is close to several key industries that are also fond of Bush, telecommunication interests, some of the banking interests, big law firms. The biggest contributor to Kerry is Mintz Levin, a Boston law firm that represents a lot of telecommunication clients. And, you know, we did 200 Freedom of Information Act requests for all the candidates, and we found letters urging the Federal Communication Commission to do favors and take a look at this or that for various clients of this law firm. We, you know, speeches, introduced legislation, you name it. And so, now part of that could be the I-28 corridor and the high-tech, you know, some of these companies are based in Massachusetts, not all of them, though, and he's very close to that industry. He's also close to a lot of the banks, Fleet Boston in Boston, which is underwriting to the tune of a couple million dollars, I think, the Democratic convention this summer in Boston. Fleet Boston, when they did a merger, he supported publicly the merger. He also does not support privatizing Social Security, which Fleet Boston and others have pushed hard and would like to see happen for obvious financial reasons for them. And so just to run down some of Kerry's folks. So you've got Mintz Levin, the law firm where his brother works, I mentioned, $230,000. Fleet Boston, Time Warner, then some law firms, Hale & Dorr, Skadden Arps, employees of Harvard University, Hill, Holiday, Connors, sounds like a law firm. Werner Lipford is a law firm. Citigroup, Goldman Sachs are also in his top 10. Now, what is interesting is there's not a labor union in any of Kerry's top 10. And, of course, a lot of it has been written about and talked about in recent weeks because Kerry adopted some of Howard Dean's rhetoric about special interests and has said he'll get rid of special interests. And so the Republicans ran an ad on the Internet, basically an email to their supporters nationwide about, you know, the charging Kerry with hypocrisy for saying he's going to get rid of special interests when there was one study by another organization that he has taken more money from lobbyists, registered lobbyists, than any other U.S. senator in the last 15 years. The thing is, Bush has probably taken more, much more than Kerry has. But you know, it is true, Kerry is well acquainted. And what makes Kerry complex is, and this is a common Democratic dilemma, is he has talked about reform. In his case, in fairness to Kerry, he has done more than talk. He has introduced legislation for 20 years to clean up politics, to go beyond McCain-Feingold, things like public financing, those kinds of issues that are not terrifically popular with most politicians. And so he's been active as a reformer to the extent you can be in the U.S. Senate. And at the same time, he has participated robustly as a senator getting money from those powerful interests, because that's the only way you're going to raise $60 million over 20-some years. So that's the story with Kerry.
We're talking to Chuck Lewis today, the author, the co-author of the new book, The Buying of the President 2004, and the executive director of the Center for Public Integrity. If you'd like to call in and ask Chuck Lewis a question about the new study on who's funding the presidential candidates or any of the work at the center, and you can learn about the center at www.publicintegrity.org. Our numbers, our lines are open, 333-9455. We do have a caller who's been very patient. Let's go to the phone lines now. Rosendale, New York, you're on the air with Chuck Lewis.
Yes, hi. I love your show. Listen to it every week.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Lewis, I'm a big fan of your work as well.
Thanks.
I have one quick technical question.
Sure.
Also, I wish you two gentlemen might talk a little bit on another subject slightly, a little bit more at length. The technical question is, what happens to campaign finance money that's raised by candidates who eventually drop out of the race? I mean, somebody like Gary Bauer or Lamar Alexander, who obviously don't have much of a chance to win, may have funds left over. Are they allowed to use that money, or do they have to kick it back to the party, or what? That's that question.
It's a great question. They cannot take the money personally, although there was a time in the 80s and 90s when House members pocketed their money after they left politics. They were allowed to keep the money, and 110 of them pocketed $10 million, which is pretty outrageous, which we could talk about. We actually investigated how much they spent on themselves, Cadillacs, Mercedes, museums in their own name. So it's right to wonder what they do with this money. But presidential campaign money, first of all, most of them drop out because they're out of cash. I mean, Sharpton is in more than $500,000 debt right now, and it's not a question of him getting out. It's when he gets out, how much debt will he have. And so the norm is to not have much money left over because, you know, as you're not winning primaries and caucuses, donors are not writing checks, and they all seem to go together. It's very rare that you see someone with a big war chest quitting. So, but that doesn't mean it's not possible that they would have some left over. You know, to be honest, I'm not 100% sure. I think that they could transfer. If you're a sitting senator like a Lamar Alexander, or you hope to go to the Senate someday, you might be able to move that to your Senate campaign account. To be honest with you, I'm not 100% sure what the rule is about that.
Yeah, you know, Chuck, if I can interject, I think that there's an example of this in 2000, if I'm not mistaken, when Pat Buchanan ran as the Reform Party candidate because he elected, for whatever reason, not to really run a very aggressive campaign, and he was allotted through public funds several million dollars based on Pro's performance in 1996.
That's right.
And I think he had quite a bit of funding left over, and I'm not sure how he used it, but I think that would be the answer to that question.
Well, that's a great question, because Buchanan hasn't done anything since, and the Reform Party is pretty much dead.
Yeah, I think he put the stake in the heart.
Yeah, exactly, and boy, now I'm going to have to go check this out.
I had heard rumors about it. I don't want to say them over the air where the money went, but yeah, I think it might be worth checking out.
Yeah, that's a good question. Anyway, thanks.
Yeah, I wanted to ask one more quick question. I mean, being able to talk to two individuals as well informed as you two guys are. I was sort of in a quandary whether to ask about, you know, Howard Stern and what's going on with him in the FCC. But what I came down to was basically I'd seen a documentary in the late 80s on Frontline called The Resurrection of Reverend Moon. And it was basically an outing of Sun Myung Moon, who he was, where he came from, who was the money behind him, and what his agenda was. He now obviously owns UPI, his company, although he says he doesn't really put his finger in the pie. I'd like to know, with all the religious right happening these days in terms of their political power, how big a player is Moon still? I know he has a lot of front groups and stuff that he organizes through. He also owns UPI, as I said. If you guys could sort of give me some feedback in terms of, you know, what's going on with Reverend Moon and his influence on politics today, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, sure. Chuck, do you want to tee off on that one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, there's honestly not as much scrutiny of Moon or the subject as there ought to be, including the religious right and the money that moves nationwide. I think it's one of the areas that needs a lot more investigation. But you know, Moon owns, of course, the Washington Times newspaper, which for most of the Bush administration, that is their preferred newspaper. And for all of the Bush administration officials, that is their Bible every day. It's not the Washington Post or New York Times, which is seen as a sort of hopelessly liberal paper by most of the conservative Republicans. So even though it's not a huge circulation paper, it's not nearly as successful financially or prominent or respected as the Washington Post, it is an exceedingly important paper inside the nation's capital. That is owned by Reverend Moon. Moon has given millions of dollars over the years to the Heritage Foundation, and now, I guess that's correct, owns UPI, although UPI has been seen generally by most journalists, at least, as pretty anemic. It's not the UPI it was when Walter Cronkite worked for it in World War II, for example. But I'm not minimizing it. It is a wire service. So exactly what the extent of his... Obviously, he has considerable influence by just the things I mentioned, and there's probably a lot of other things that I'm not mentioning because I'm not a complete expert on Moon. But you know, there is something very interesting about Moon, and it's still generally not discussed and understood as well as it ought to be. And the religious right in general and their influence on this administration and the money flows are, I think, really desperately in need of investigation.
We're talking to Chuck Lewis, who you've just heard, Charles Lewis, the executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, who's also the author of the new book, The Buying of the President 2004, here on Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a live show, so if you want to call in and ask Chuck Lewis a question, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Chuck, you know, a little background before we go to our next caller who's patiently waiting. You know, you were a very successful producer in commercial journalism for many years. Why did you decide to leave commercial journalism and launch the Center for Public Integrity? And when did you do it? And, you know, what's the thinking behind it?
Well, some people thought I'd lost my mind, so getting into the thinking is precarious.
What's a zone our listeners are used to? So.
Okay. Well, no, I was a producer for Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes, and it's true, I had been there for 5 years, and I'd been at ABC for 6.5 years before that, and, you know, my piece led the show on 60, and the next morning I resigned and broke a 4-year contract and had a wife and a daughter, an infant daughter, and no savings and a mortgage, and just walked cold turkey away from the job and the business. It's very, very impetuous. I wouldn't necessarily recommend anybody do something like that. But I was frustrated with television in general. I mean, obviously I was frustrated where I was working, but I had been in TV enough to know that the medium itself was getting on my nerves, shooting people tight and, you know, waiting for them to cry. And if you didn't have either victims crying on camera or dead bodies, you know, it might be a terrible situation you're investigating, but if there were no dead people that you could show pictures of their gravestone or, you know, their talk to their family. I mean, it was the emotive element that was always desperately important for every piece. Some of those kinds of issues are really frustrating to me because I investigate stuff and I didn't care if the bad guy didn't go on camera. So what? I mean, I think that you should do a story regardless of whether the audience gets this, the bad guy gets his or her comeuppance. So the theater and the drama elements of television in general were getting a little tiresome to me. And so then the idea was, where could you investigate something, to your heart's content, literally take years if necessary, involve dozens of researchers, not worry about ratings, not worry about time and space limitations. And I realized there was really nowhere to do that in newspapers or television. And so an idea took form to maybe create a nonprofit, which I'd never done. I'd never created anything, let alone a nonprofit organization. But I realized that it might be a possibility. And all the names were taken that had investigative reporting or investigative journalism in them. And plus, a lot of people hate investigative reporters. So I did the name around public integrity because everything I would ever want to investigate, I figured, involved those issues. Even though it sounded like a Lyndon LaRouche front group, I tried to get past that. So anyway, I started from my house, and I got two friends who didn't know each other to be on the board with me. Naturally, I was the chairman. And
this is early 90s now?
It was incorporated March of 89.
Okay.
And I left 60 Minutes in November of 88.
Okay.
And started working full-time, day-to-day, trying to make this work out of a guest bedroom in my suburban Virginia house outside D.C. And anyway, that first employee was an intern from University of Southern California. I had enough for a lease for a first office in downtown D.C., $60,000, I think, two-year lease that I had to list my house as collateral or something, but I didn't have enough for furniture. So it was that kind of a thing, brick by brick enterprise. First, funding was from a foundation, from a consulting contract with a TV network, ABC News. ABC and CNN and others tried to hire me when I quit 60 Minutes, and I didn't want to go to work for any of them, but they then wanted our investigative stuff. Our, at that time, was me, but I mean the organization as it was being created. And then there were companies and labor unions initially that helped fund the center, but I phased that out after a few years because we were often investigating them, mm-hmm. and it became tricky, and also I didn't want to make it easy for critics to try to nail us or impugn our, integrity in terms of motive. And so anyway, it was just that's how it started. The idea was to try to do it in a different way, and, it's evolved over about 15 years now.
Has it ever? Yeah. Where do you stand today?
Well, we have an annual budget of $4.3 million, staff of 40, and we've done about 250 investigative reports and 12 books, and we've been honored about 23 times by various distinguished journalism organizations like Investigative Reporters and Editors, Society of Professional Journalists. We just won a George Polk Award for posting all the Iraq contracts, and we've been quoted about 9,000 times in the American media for our findings or our perspective from our work. And so, yeah, it's worked out. We also have 92 investigative reporters in 48 countries, a network of international investigative reporters beyond the 40-person staff. Plus, we have about 15 or 20 paid interns every year from various schools around the country. And so it's really worked out in a very exciting way that, honestly, you couldn't necessarily predict back in the late 80s.
I've got 1,000 questions I want to ask you, but that would be unfair to our loyal listeners. We've got a bunch of people who are waiting to talk to Chuck Lewis, the author of the new book, The Buying of the President 2004, and I promise we'll get to all of you. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Chuck Lewis.
Yeah, thank you. Two quick comments and then a question.
Sure.
My comments are that I'm really going to have to read your book because I really want to know more about these 49 favors you've managed to list about Bush doing favors for Enron and the losing of the paperwork on $60 million in contributions. I've got to read about that. Comment two, you were talking about getting money after getting bonuses. giving bonuses and, you know, giving a wink and a nod. You didn't mention the biggest bonus of all, and that was Bush's tax cut for the rich, which definitely was followed with a wink and a nod. And but here's my question. I've got a more of a naive notion of what this money does in our politics. Like, I tend to think that it's enough to flood the media with your message, you know, make the other guy seem like a minority point of view. And I was curious if you have a more sophisticated point of view. I know you're more into what the sources of the money, but to talk about what's done with the money for a second, other than just, you know, expecting favors. Could you speak to that at all? I'll hang up.
Yeah, and Chuck, this actually is an excellent question because you just wrote a piece that I saw online about political mugging and these independent smear campaigns. Maybe you could weave that into your answer.
No, sure. Well, I mean, what it buys is a good amount, of course, is for political ads, and as no one in the country knows better or has discussed more eloquently than Bob McChesney, the whole issue of paid media and how difficult it is for a politician, any party, to get heard. You can't expect the news media itself to cover it particularly well or thoroughly, and especially the substance of the issues involved in any campaign. And the amount of campaign coverage is radically changing and decreasing, actually, in our country. And so it's essential to get your message out, and that has to be with paid media. So one of the reasons campaigns are so expensive is absolutely true. You must raise money for ads. But there's wordsmithing involved, focus groups, getting together how best to say this and that and what phrasing to use, and, you know, grassroots support, phone banking, all kinds of consultant strategic work. The more people, the more money you have, the more people you have, the more thorough you know, most things in the world, unfortunately, when it comes to goods and services, the more you have, the more you can do. And that's true of any candidate. 90% of the candidates that have the most money and run in politics at the national level in Congress, for example, get elected, and it's not a surprise why. The more you're heard, the more you're known, the more leaflets you drop at people's front doors, you name it, you're going to have a better shot. And that's just how it works, and it's why we have 98% incumbent retention rate for the last three House of Representatives elections in the nation. It sounds like North Korea, but it's the U.S., and that's you can do technical designer district redistricting when you have fancy computers, and, you know, and so money begets power and keeps power. It's that simple, and there are different ways to get into that. But to examine what it buys, it goes way, way, way past ads. In most congressional races, ads only account for about 30% of what the money goes for. In presidential, it's a little higher, I think. But the other thing that can be done with money is, and what is particularly insidious to me, and I'm very interested in it, and it's on our website right now as the first item, is political mugging in America. You can, you know, in Iowa, what happened is donors and fundraisers for Gephardt, Kerry, and Wesley Clark got together to try to stop Dean. And so what they did is they created a group called Americans for Jobs, and they raised, in a matter of 6 weeks, about $600,000 and ran ads that had Osama bin Laden's image linking it with Dean's and just totally trashing Dean all over the place in Iowa. No one in Iowa could figure out where the money came from. The disclosure, the way it's set up for these outside groups, which are known as 527 political organizations, no one could find to the records. Their records were not legally required to be filed until February. Of course, the caucuses were on January 21st. Yeah. Not terribly helpful. So anyway, we have gone through the records now, and we've studied exactly who did what and who exactly funded it, and we confronted the person who did it all. And we went to their office and took a picture of their building, 2000 M Street, and we show how you can, you know, this is basically a rumble after dark. This is how you do in a candidate and get rid of them, essentially. Now, I don't want to suggest that the whole Dean phenomenon and the extraordinary situation of someone raising $50 million from 340,000 donors and dropping like a stone despite that, it was because of this mugging. There are a lot of factors probably that almost certainly that went into what happened to Dean. I'm not in any way saying this was the only thing that happened to him or that it explains everything, because it doesn't. But you know, money can do a lot of damage in politics. If you look at what happened to McCain in South Carolina in the 2000 election, after he'd surprisingly won New Hampshire, decisively won New Hampshire, his whole campaign was stopped dead when Bush and outside groups friendly to Bush spent $20 or $25 million to McCain's $3 million in South Carolina. And I could go on and on, but money is, you know, extremely important, as in essential, in politics. And it's exceedingly rare that an underfunded candidate ever wins. I mean, yes, it occasionally happens. Paul Wellstone was a great example of someone underfunded, but having very clever ads and a very, brilliant campaign, despite the lack of resources. It does happen occasionally, but it's not common.
We're talking to Chuck Lewis today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Chuck Lewis is the author of the new book, The Buying of the President, 2004. We've been talking about it. He is also the founder and executive director for the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit, nonpartisan watchdog organization in Washington that does investigative reporting and research. You can go find out about the stories that the Center for Public Integrity works on at their website, www.publicintegrity.org. And Chuck, as I was listening to your answer just now and really just thinking about the work that the center does, one of the things that's striking is so many stories you're breaking simply aren't being covered by the plethora of hardworking journalists and reporters we have in our mainstream news media, even though they strike me as being exceptionally important. I mean, the story, for example, you just told about the attack on Dean, you would hope that good political journalism would be all over this in a free society. So this sort of stuff is brought to the attention of people who live here, voters, citizens. Yet, unfortunately, in this case and in all too many others, the center almost seems to be out there alone working on these issues. Why is that? Why are stories like this, or the missing $60 million or whatever that was, of Bush donors, why aren't these headline front page stories? Why aren't they all over the place, given their importance?
Well, it's you and I would need several hours to go into that. But I mean, the short answer is, well, I mean, honestly, I'm not entirely sure myself. But either the journalists are too strapped, they're too busy, they're too distracted, or there's no interest by them or their bosses. Depends on the day and the organization and the story. Some of the political mugging, there were little stories that were buried by some of the elite newspapers, but it's not just do they cover it, it's do they cover it well in a prominent way that we remember. You know, it's one thing to do a little three-paragraph squib in page 19, and it's another thing to do it on page 1 above the fold. And so, that is something we've noticed a lot of, that yeah. we're frequently the only ones doing things, and I think that every news organization could do so much more, and they all certainly have more resources than we do. In fairness to them, we are doing very precise things, looking at political influence and who's distorting, at least to us, it appears, who is distorting democracy or trying to do something involving power and money, and not just money all the time either. There's other things we look at, but we have an unusual beat, I guess you'd say. We don't have to cover the whole world and who's fighting and mm-hmm. here, and I mean every bill in Congress and all the other things. We're looking at a very, very particular thing that others should be looking at. But I mean, for example, on next week, Tuesday or Wednesday, 80,000 records in the McCain-Feingold case are going to be shredded. Hmm. And it's painful that a judge would not unseal the records, and then there was a date set when all the litigants have to destroy all of the discovery records. Well, this is killing me.
Yeah, that's like torching library books.
It's incredibly painful.
And, yeah, I can imagine. You know, one of the great stories that the center broke a few years ago was President Bush's business practices with Harkin prior to becoming governor of Texas. And what was striking there was not only was the story not really picked up and covered in the news media, although the center released its report and its findings, compared to the way President Clinton's business practices with Whitewater were covered, it seemed like there was an enormous disparity between the amount of coverage Clinton's alleged business behavior got received in the news media compared to what George W. Bush's practices received.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I haven't done a sort of a content analysis the way that you or your researchers would do. But
yeah,
I mean,
but it's about a 10 or 20 or 30 to 1 ratio.
That's how it feels.
Yeah.
Me too. Well, no, we could. You're right. I mean, absolutely right. And I don't know what that was about. We were fortunate enough to have 1,000 pages of internal records from Harkin from the Buying the Present 2000 book, actually, from the research there. Why? The ostensible reason all the media gave for not covering it was that it was an old story, quote-unquote, that, you know, the Texas papers and others had covered it in the early 90s, and they just didn't think there was anything there. We certainly didn't agree with them on that, and when all the corporate responsibility stuff came out in 2002, when Enron and WorldCom and all these other fraudulent situations emerged, suddenly his background was incredibly important to the nation, and no one... some of the media had rediscovered the Harkin subject. They had basically ignored it in the 2000 election. But, you know, it is pathetic. The media should be a lot better than it is, and it's a source of unending frustration. I try to, you can see I'm in some state of denial about it. If I obsess about it, about how little our stuff gets covered. Some of it gets covered really well. Much of it doesn't. And as you and I once talked, any investigations we do about companies basically is very hardly covered at all.
Yeah, corporate malfeasance is more or less off limits.
Yeah, that's right. And when it's some hapless politician doing something either incompetent or worse, that's usually a wonderful story, and all the media loves that one. And so that's also what's troubling, is I unfortunately know what works for these guys.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to pander to what I know will work for them in terms of coverage, and we do both, and we have all that stuff on our site for people to look at. But I know when I knew when we did 49 favors for Enron, which is on the website for the caller earlier. I think in January, February of 2003 is when that appeared. I knew that no one would cover it in the country. And that was a reporter working on it for 3 months, going through an extraordinary amount of records to pull all that material. But we felt we had to do it because everyone was wondering about Bush and Enron and also the favors in Enron. And most obnoxiously, a lot of defenders of Enron and of Bush were saying, well, so what if they gave a lot of money? Can you really show that they got anything? I mean, if they got anything, why would they be going bankrupt? And, you know, I wanted to smack them silly and shake them by the lapels when I hear stuff like that. But so I wanted to just show what they had gotten because I was astonished at some of the things I was hearing after the Enron thing hit. So bottom line is, it's terrible and it's terribly frustrating. And that's the beauty of the web now. Is the good news is, the hopeful news is that there are other things like your show, like the center and its work with the web. I mean, the exciting thing is that you can get investigative information through other means. And I think, the American people are becoming increasingly sophisticated and understanding that they've got just like when they shop, they've got to shop around for information.
Well, on that note, we have two very patient people who have been waiting to talk to you. We've only got a couple minutes left.
Yeah,
so
sorry.
That's good. I could let you go on. We could do like a marathon with you.
Should
be like a 24-hour show.
We could.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Chuck Lewis.
Yes, hello for taking my call. Thank you. The one thing I wanted to comment about is the newspaper people and the people on television always seem to mention that they feel that Kerry is aloof and distant and doesn't really care about people, but if anybody had been watching the C-SPAN focus groups and the various small groups he was in, I found him to be listen very much to the people and to take to heart what they said and to try to answer them as honestly as he could without saying that he could take care of everything. And I'm just wondering why the media wants to portray him that way. Secondly, Vice President Cheney, have you studied him much? This morning on Meet the Press, Tim Russert asked if he would be put aside for another vice presidential candidate because of the baggage he carries, and the Republican person said that she just cannot believe the lies and exaggerations about Cheney, and that he's just such a steady leader and a wonderful patriot and just wants to do what's best for our country. And the other thing is Rush Limbaugh, the impact that he has. I've watched so much of both Democrat and Republican speeches and conventions and so forth, and he just out and out lies and exaggerates and gives misleading innuendos, and it's so frustrating because I know so many people believe him and espouse it then and go on further to their neighbors.
Caller, I tell you, we're running short, caller. So I think, Chuck, the second question about Cheney in particular is right up your alley.
Right.
Have you done some research on his business practices and his sort of funding issues?
Oh, yeah, we've done a lot of stuff. We did the first investigative report that I'm aware of Cheney and Halliburton back in August of 2000. It's on our website. We know about him doubling the lobbying, the contributions, and the federal government contracts.
So Chuck, I think what I'm going to have to do is send people to your website so we can get to this last caller. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently.
Sure.
Line 4, I thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Chuck Lewis. Hello?
Is that me?
That's you, finally. I know you probably.
All right. Quickly, I cannot see myself voting for either Kerry or Bush. And the thing is, regarding campaign reform, I don't think McCain's bill would work out. I think that we cannot have any lobbyists, and the candidates all have equal time on, say, National Public Radio or something, and debate. And we don't have to rely on the reporters asking stupid questions.
Okay. Do you want to let Chuck answer that?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Your thoughts, Chuck?
Well, I mean, we're not going to get rid of lobbyists because of the Constitution. Everyone from the Girl Scouts to General Motors to individual citizens think and believe they have a right to petition their government. So, we have 25,000 lobbyists today. There were about 62 of them in 1968. They've proliferated. They're a source of unending problems. But probably restricting their access to power after they leave is about as much as you can do in terms of the law. Regarding, that is the whole issue of free airtime, essentially, as you know, which mm-hmm. you was alluding to. You know, we talked to Jimmy Carter. The most animation and passion that he displayed in the interview with him was his anger over what's happened to America and how the media companies are profiteering from democracy.
You know what, Chuck, you might hear that our band is tuning up in the background.
Yeah, okay.
Which means it's time for us to go out of the studio. I want to thank Charles Lewis, the Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity, for joining us today in Media Matters. He's the author of The Buying of the President 2004. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I want to thank Victor Ricard, the producer. I'll see you a week from today with Janine Garofalo. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from Europe, the Middle East, India, and around the world. Food tastings are held every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of sprinkles or flurries. Windy with a high near 50 degrees and northwest winds 20 to 30 miles per hour and gusting. Tonight, mostly cloudy in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy. Brisk with a low in the upper 20s and northwest winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. The high in the upper 40s with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.